Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The governor said today he's working on a plan to address the coronavirus. We look at its impact, starting with the PAX East Gaming Convention happening here.
We've got hand sanitizer stations at pretty much every single place around here. You'll see teams regularly wiping down their equipment with Lysol wipes and stuff.
On Super Tuesday, Newton votes on a major mixed-use development.
What kind of neighborhood do you want to live in? Do you want it to be gridlocked half the time?
I want to stand for well-informed and thoughtful hope for a strong future for our community.
We'll take your calls on what it means for the region. And remembering Steve Ross, Holocaust survivor and founder of the New England Holocaust Memorial.
We began to realize that we are no longer human beings. We just were zombies.
It's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to spend the first part of this hour talking about the effects of the coronavirus here in the region. Governor Baker addressed the issue today, stressing that the risk for contracting the virus remains low in the state, but he's been in daily contact with federal and local agencies since the beginning of the outbreak globally.
I would expect that the beginning of next week, we'll probably have a fully formulated plan that we can show people.
So that announcement comes as PAX East kicks off today at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. The annual video game convention brings together some of the biggest names in the industry. But this year, some companies like Sony and Facebook are missing the convention due to the concerns about the spreading coronavirus. WBUR's Callum Borchers is at PAX East right now. You can hear it. And he joins us from there. Hey there, Callum.
Hey, Tiziana.
So I can tell it's noisy, Callum. What else is it like there?
Well, at the moment, Tiziana, I'm standing next to an actual castle. I mean, this is like a 12-foot-high structure that a video game studio called Motion 20... Of course, right? They've erected this giant castle in the middle of the convention floor. There are people in costumes everywhere. It's kind of like Halloween in February. It's also a bit like a drag show, Tiziana. You know, we've done these segments on the show about gender-bending fashion. This is the place to find it. You've got a lot of men here dressed up as their favorite female characters from video games. It is really quite a place.
All right, so how is attendance? Again, I've noted it sounds quite busy, but how is the attendance stacking up to previous years? And have you heard either people express concerns or seen any, you know, unusual or notable precautions we might not have seen in previous years?
Yeah, well, I mean, people who've been coming to PAX East for a long time, Tiziana, tell me this is actually a really good turnout for a Thursday, which is usually the first day of the convention. On my T-ride over, I saw a tweet about someone wearing a full hazmat suit here at PAX East. I've been unable to find this person, but I do see people taking some health precautions.
I guess we don't know if that was a costume or a hazmat suit
right,
either.
Right, it might have been a joke. Exactly. It could have been a joke or it could have been a legitimate precaution. But
right.
I met a fellow named Luther Patanji. He's a writer and game designer at a small gaming studio in San Francisco called the Joy Manufacturing Company. And he says people are being really vigilant about their hygiene here.
Well, of course, there are concerns about coronavirus. Everyone at PAX has been on guard with being about as safe as humanly possible. We've got hand sanitizer stations at pretty much every single place around here. You'll see teams regularly wiping down their equipment with Lysol wipes and stuff.
And I'll mention that Patanji was telling me this as he was dressed in a full dress and wig and rouge. He's the star of his video game called Ambition, which is about a 19th century woman in Paris. I'm also seeing, Tiziana, people in those surgical masks, including a man named Vlad Sipliak. He's the co-founder of a Taiwanese video game company called Another Indie. So I asked him about the mask.
I'm from Asia. I'm just used to it. It's not because of the virus. I wear it every time I'm at convention, just not to get sick. Because after this, we have to fly to San Francisco for GDC, so I don't want to get sick in the middle.
And the GDC that he mentioned there, Tiziana, is the Game Developers Conference, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. And they're also seeing some dropouts, just like PAX East here.
So to that point of dropouts, I mentioned that Sony pulled out over concerns. Can you tell us any more about that? And why would an event like PAX East be that kind of concern?
Well, Sony made the decision last week, and I think the key phrase in its statement about the decision was this. It said, quote, global travel restrictions are changing daily. And so it wasn't about a specific threat here in Boston so much as about the uncertainty. And, of course, Sony is based in Japan, which just today, Tiziana, has asked all of its schools to close for about a month to try to halt the virus's spread. So you could imagine if you were part of the Sony contingent here in Boston this week and then something like that happened back home, you wouldn't certainly want to get caught up in transit. So I think it was really sort of a better safe than sorry type of thing for Sony.
So, Callum, it sounds like a boisterous first day. Is Sony's absence affecting enthusiasm among the attendees, or are people talking about that decision and questioning it?
They are talking about it, and some people are disappointed because they were expecting to play a new Sony game called The Last of Us 2 for the first time. But I think that people generally here know the kinds of things that Sony has to offer. They're looking forward to the release of PlayStation 5. A lot of attendees come here, Tiziana, to try to discover something new. So you see a lot of independent game developers here.
So, you know, Callum, WBUR has been reporting on how fears about the coronavirus have been negatively impacting businesses here in the area, for example, Chinatown. Any overlap with what we're seeing at PAX East and what we've been seeing with businesses here in Boston?
Right. I mean, it doesn't seem to have harmed the attendance so far, but the common worry I think you're talking about there is racism. I mean, people who have an irrational fear of going to Chinatown might also fear coming to PAX East here because it's a huge international event with a lot of people traveling here from Asia. I talked about this with an attendee named Norma Heller. She's a local. She's from Boston. She came dressed as the character Maya from the game Borderlands 2, and here's what she told me.
There's definitely a lot of racism around the fear-mongering, for sure, but we're going out to Chinatown for dinner tonight, so it hasn't touched us, at least.
And so here, at least, Tiziana, I mean, that seems to be the prevailing attitude. You know, take reasonable precautions, but don't be afraid of whole groups of people.
Well, that's good to hear. And that is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers. Thanks for taking the time out with us, Callum. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
All right, so the gaming industry isn't the only part of the economy affected by COVID-19 or this coronavirus. Here to talk about the overall economic impact is Evan Horowitz, executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University, also a former Boston Globe economics reporter. Welcome back, Evan.
Tiziana, it's great to be here.
All right, so we know this virus is spreading. There are some fears that it could become a global pandemic. Global pandemics affect global economies, don't they?
So, two things to say. One, I think we're past fear that it becomes a global pandemic and closer to likelihood that it becomes a global pandemic. The other is that the economic effects have already started. So really it's a two-part conversation. It's there have already been substantial economic effects in China that will ripple out. There could be ongoing effects in Europe and eventually in the United States.
Can you characterize a little bit about these substantial economic effects in China that we've already seen?
So the way to think about it really is to think about companies and their supply chains, where if you're a big technology company, do you actually manufacture your parts, your phones? Or if you're a big car company, where do you actually get the parts from your cars? And in a lot of cases, the answer is China.
So, and you mean a big technology or car company anywhere in the world?
I mean, particularly in Silicon Valley. I mean, if you're a big technology company in California, it doesn't mean you make your parts in California. It means most likely you make them in China or you have them made in China. And if people are sick in China, they can't go to work to make those parts. If there are quarantines that force them to stay at home, they can't go make those parts. If those parts then have to get shipped to the United States and nobody's at the port or not enough people are at the port, they can't get on the boat, they can't get here or cargo planes, whatever it is. So this is not a future eventuality. It's already baked in. It just hasn't showed up in the statistics yet because there's a statistics lag. But part of this is done, that China, the Chinese economy is already suffering and that will affect us. And the question is, how dramatic are the future effects as the virus spreads?
So you captured my attention with this phrase, the statistics lag. How long is that lag? When will stuff like this actually start to show up?
I think in the next month you'll start to see it in the trade data and then moving forward in GDP. So, I mean, I think soon. Oh, soon. Yeah. It will not take 6 months, but it could take 2 or 3 months. And it took the markets a little longer than I expected to recognize this. But obviously, they've caught on and are crashing as a result.
Okay. So let's talk about that because, wow, what a week in the markets.
Understatement. Yes. So in the stock market in particular, the bond markets caught on sooner. There have been troubles in the bond markets for a few weeks now, and that's not unusual.
How come?
Bond traders tend to be a little more sensitive to these kinds of baseline economic risks, and the stock market can hover on optimism for a lot longer than the bond market can. So it's not unusual to see this kind of divergence, but it doesn't last. You know, you could think of it as like a mawing gap. You know, they get further and further apart, and then they crack together.
They correct, kind of.
Yeah. And that's what's happening this week. The stock market has collapsed down to where the bond market was in. And that's not – I mean, it's not surprising for a couple of reasons. One, stocks seem overvalued independent of the question of coronavirus. Two, coronavirus is going to affect the real economy, which affects the profitability of firms, which is what the stock market is really about. So traders are recognizing that and starting to price it in.
So I'm aware both of the volatility of the markets and also people talk about sort of the irrational reactions of the markets. Do you anticipate this kind of instability in the stock market to go on for a while, or are we sort of seeing this catching up between the bond and the stock market and maybe next week things level off a little?
Man, if I knew, I would not be here. I think, you know, the safe bet is always to expect volatility in the stock market. But no, I don't. I mean, if I had to guess, I don't think it's over because, as I said, I think the ripple effects in the real economy are just beginning to show up and they're going to amplify in the days and weeks and months ahead.
So let's go back to that ripple effects in the real economy. You know, we've been here at Radio Boston talking about, okay, we got to be careful to be clear that there's a difference between the stock market and the overall economy. I also looked it up. Gallup says that as of April of last year, only 55% of Americans even owned a stock. But everybody's plugged into the economy. When might we start to see or feel that kind of economic impact in everyday life of, you know, the average Bostonian, for example?
Okay, so you think about it, one on the disease side and two on the economy side. I think it's going to start showing up on the economy side relatively soon in the form of likely it's a traditional called supply side shock. So basically what it means is if it's harder to make things, harder to ship them, more expensive to do that, then prices are likely to go up and the supply of things is likely to go down. So it'll be harder to find things and things will get a little bit more expensive. The extent of that is still up in the air because it depends on how far the disease spreads and whatnot. But that's going to happen and people are going to start to see it. And then the other side of it is people are going to start worried about getting sick.
Okay.
And that means they may not go to work. They may have to stay home with their kids. They may not want to go to the supermarket to do shopping. And that's going to affect their daily lives. And of course, that's also going to plug into the U.S. economy. If people aren't going out to go grocery shopping, then supermarkets aren't going to be selling as many things. So I don't think it will be long before there are kind of real world impact on people's lives.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. So in that, let me just ask you long term implications. And I don't mean to sound callous, but bad and good that could come from this.
Well, the bad is obvious. So let's look at the good for 30 seconds. There will be new pressure, I think, for a more rapid path to vaccine development. And there's talk of that, and the FDA is interested in that. And I think that's something that will be helpful, not just for this, but for future pandemics. So that's good. And the other good may be in Chinese politics. One of the things that a pandemic tends to do is to delegitimize regimes, because the regime in China clearly wasn't as responsive as necessary to the early warning signs here. So there's a possible upside in terms of Chinese political transparency.
Okay. Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University and a former Globe Economics reporter. Thanks.
Thank you, Tizian.
All right. And listeners, listen, tomorrow on the show, we are going to have all three local winners of the 2019 Nobel Economics Peace Prize, Economics Prize. That's MIT economist Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee and Harvard economist Michael Kremer. Their work focuses on the economics of poverty and how economics can be used to uplift all people. Should be a fabulous conversation. We'll take your calls and questions for them. That's tomorrow at 3 on WBUR's Radio Boston. For now, stick around. There's more coming. I'm Tiziana, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Steve Ross died on Monday. He was the Holocaust survivor who helped found the New England Holocaust Memorial in Boston. Documents list him as having been 88 years old, but friends and family believed him to have been 93. Ross came to Boston as an orphan and refugee after World War II. He was just 9 years old when he was first imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. Over the next 5 years, he was starved, beaten, experimented on, forced into labor, and terrorized at 10 different death camps. He told his story in a 2017 documentary.
One time, I stole a potato. A guard told me, he came over, he pulled me by the ear away, and he gave me 25 lashes with a lead pipe. And they broke my back. Today, I can't walk too well.
On April 29th, 1945, American soldiers liberated Dachau. Some 30,000 Holocaust survivors were freed. Steve Ross was among them. As he walked away from the camp, he said he came upon a U.S. Army lieutenant sitting on a tank, eating. What happened next transformed his life.
After I was rescued from hell in the Valley of Death, I came upon a soldier on a tank that showed me compassion for the first time, concern, and took me back to God, to civilization and mankind. He gave me his food. He put his arm around me, and he gave me a flag.
It also set him on a path that eventually led to Dorchester, Massachusetts, where he worked with at-risk youth in Boston and tried to ensure that such evil was never forgotten. Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty spoke to Roger Lyons, who directed the documentary Etched in Glass, The Legacy of Steve Ross, back in 2017 when the film came out. He started by telling us about how he met Steve Ross.
I was assigned to do one-minute profiles of unsung heroes in the community way back in 2000. And somebody suggested that I call Steve Ross and maybe do a profile of him. And so I did. I called him up, and after a two-hour phone conversation with basically no pause in it, I thought, wow, what a great story. So I went down to the memorial, interviewed him, and just having seen the passion come out of him and this just compelling story, made me think that somehow somebody needed to do a longer piece than 45 seconds or a minute. And so I basically self-funded a bunch of shoots and followed him around and saw him in action speaking to kids in Boston High School and other places and just really inspiring them.
I mean, first, it just astonishes me that you had to try and fit his story into a 45-second piece. I mean, impossible because it's so profound, right?
I mean,
tell us more about Steve's experiences in the death camps. I mean, being in prison when he was first just 9 years old.
Well, his parents actually tried to avoid that by sending him off with some farmers in Krasnik, who ultimately had to send him to the woods because the Nazis were going to kill anybody harboring Jews. So young Steve at 9 years old was in the woods with the partisans all by himself, basically, and the Nazis found him, saw that he was circumcised, said, "You're a Jew," and then encamped him for 5 years. So it was just a horrible situation. Everything you've seen on Schindler's List basically happened to Steve multiple times. And yet he endured, and he really, his will to live and his will to tell people what really happened was what kept him going.
Well, I don't ever like using sort of film analogies here, but the Schindler's List one is appropriate because, I mean, in the documentary, we learn that Steve had to hide in the feces of an outhouse as Nazi soldiers were murdering children, that he once grabbed onto the axle of a train to escape a camp, only to end up in another camp. Obviously beaten and starved repeatedly. The cumulative effect of that, I still cannot imagine, but I just want to play a little bit more of tape from the documentary here of one of the effects that Steve himself describes that all this had on him.
We began to realize that we are no longer human beings. We just were zombies living in a world that will not aid us.
Roger, talk to me more about this, because while Steve describes that, you know, he almost had to make himself into a kind of a zombie, here clearly is a man who never lost his humanity. Never, never.
Right. And he never gave up. He really wanted to live to tell the world what had happened. And so what he did ultimately, there were years where he just got beaten down and there was really not much he could do, but he basically started to act on trying to get out of there, which is why he literally ran under and grabbed the underneath of a train and got out of Auschwitz just after being tattooed with numbers on his arms. And he escaped, again, yes, to find another death camp. But from every place he went, he tried to get out. And that was a difference between him and a lot of other folks who were encamped in there.
And he survived those attempts. I mean, like, he survived what I'm sure was a retribution in trying to get out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, in the introduction to our conversation, we played a clip from the film. Again, the film is called Etched in Glass, where Steve describes the amazing experience he had upon his liberation from Dachau, encountering that U.S. soldier. Two quick things I want to ask you about that. First of all, my guess is that it would have been his first encounter with an Allied soldier, right? Like that,
right.
Every other soldier he'd met before that was probably a Nazi, right?
Right, they absolutely were. That's correct.
And that flag. Now, Steve's son is Mike Ross.
Correct.
He's the former Boston City Councilor. Just wanted to note that for folks who might have been wondering. But in terms of the flag that the soldier gave to Steve Ross, he still has that?
Yes. Well, he was given food. The soldier jumped off a tank, gave him some food at a hug, you know, an act of kindness.
Yeah.
And gave him this cloth to wipe the dirt off his face and tears and everything. And Steve, being a Polish kid, had no idea what this was. But he kept it as a memento. And he realized later on that it was an American flag. And at that point, he was driven to go to America and find that soldier to thank him for helping him out and showing him that act of kindness.
Did he find the soldier?
Well, you'd have to see the film.
Okay.
Because it comes a long way. He actually searched for the soldier for 67 years. And he was just driven to find this person.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. We're not going to ask you to give everything away. But tell us the story, though, of how Steve came to Boston.
Steve came over from the DP camps in Germany, originally to New York, and then came to Boston and lived in an orphanage in Dorchester. And he met some other folks. It really was sort of a place for wayward Jewish orphans of the war to be. And he met Bob Berger and some other folks that he became very friendly with. And he ended up remembering that his mother told him in order to be a great man, he really needed to get an education. And so his goal was to get educated, and he worked his way through three colleges, even though he started off speaking no English. Three college degrees, became a licensed psychologist in the city of Boston, became a street worker with Mayor Ray Flynn, former Mayor Ray Flynn, and helped young kids stay out of trouble.
Yeah. Now, the film is called Etched in Glass because Steve Ross is the major force, or one of the major forces, in the creation of the New England Holocaust Memorial.
That's correct.
Yeah. Remind us what he did to make that happen.
It was his idea to do this, to build some kind of memorial to those who were fallen and killed and whatever back in the war. But he wanted to put something together where people could gather and pray for their ancestors, pray for the Jewish people, just a place, a physical place to go. And so he got together, as it turns out, having already worked with Ray Flynn as a street worker. Now Ray Flynn was the mayor, and he worked with Ray to get that parcel of land that's on the Freedom Trail. And then he went after a huge fundraising campaign with Bill Carman of Newton and some others to raise enough money to build a huge monument to the people who were fallen.
Yeah. We just got a minute to go here, Roger. I wonder, the Holocaust Memorial has been vandalized twice recently. I just wonder what Steve feels about sort of where we find ourselves as a nation today, you know, with the rise of the extreme right wing, a resurgence in anti-Semitic rhetoric and actions. I mean, it pains me. I can't even imagine how he feels about this.
Right. Well, the first shoot I did with him after my little interview was at a Stop the Hate event at Boston High School. He's been on a campaign, anti-hate campaign, since he was born, really, but from the camps. That's been his thing. And so this kind of vandalism that really destroys something that's supposed to be a monument, a positive thing, is really something that he's been working his whole life against.
That was filmmaker Roger Lyons speaking about Holocaust survivor Steve Ross with Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2017. Ross died on Monday. His family say he was 93 years old. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are going to spend the rest of the hour today talking about a mixed-use development in Newton. At issue is a 23-acre plot in the Newton Village of Upper Falls, which Northland developers plan on turning into some 800 apartments, 140 deeded affordable, 180,000 square feet of offices, and 115,000 square feet of shops, parks, and restaurants. The project's required zoning changes and special permitting were passed by the Newton City Council with the requisite two-thirds vote, a final vote tally of 17-7 in favor. But opponents to the project have organized a referendum to overturn that, and city voters will cast their votes on that referendum next Tuesday, March 3rd. Now, we on this show, we talk about housing and transportation a lot, and we know that it is top of mind for so many of our listeners and for so many people in the Commonwealth. So we want to talk about what this project would do, what the opposition would like to see, and what the implications of this case could mean for other communities in Massachusetts. Joining us here in the studio to do that, here in Studio 3, first is Deb Crossley. She's a counselor at large from Ward 5 in Newton, where the project's located. She's an architect and currently chairs the city's Zoning and Planning Committee and voted to approve Northland. Counselor Crossley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Randy Block. He is president of Right Size Newton, a community organization opposed to the project that participated in organizing the voter referendum. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as we get started, I want to first say I want to note that I am a resident of Newton myself, and I want to note that we want you to pull up a chair and join the conversation. If you live in Newton, do you support this project or oppose it, and why? Outside of Newton, do you think it should be easier or harder to build new housing, affordable housing? What about arguments about traffic congestion, school overcrowding? Do they resonate with you, and how to address them? Or do you think big projects like this should always go to voters, like with like the referendum that's coming? We just want to know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Deb, I'm going to start with you. From your perspective, what would the Northland development mean for Newton?
Well, I think this project exemplifies what we need to do in order to address real community needs that we've identified over decades. And city leaders have been planning over decades to try to find space in Newton to address some of these needs. Housing. We need more elevator accessible housing. We need more smaller units. We need more deed restricted affordable units. This project would bring the largest bunch of affordable housing to the city in a very long time, deed restricted in perpetuity. Open space. You actually said at the beginning that we had 115,000 square feet of retail and parks and open space. It's actually 115,000 square feet of first floor supportive retail. There's almost 10 acres of what's called usable open space, a mix of parks and playgrounds and plaza, landscape public plazas. And
that
so
are
forth,
part of the planned development.
That are part of the planned development.
Thank you for that.
So it's a very large proportion of space for people to gather and meet and walk and talk. It's a highly walkable environment. People keep saying, you know, we want places where the community can gather. This does that.
Maybe I just want to say maybe give me one more benefit because then I want to bring Randy's voice.
Environmental controls. Very strong environmental controls. Contributions to our infrastructure, state-of-the-art stormwater management plan, and the highest tier of building energy efficiency is incorporated into this plan.
Okay, so thank you. That's helpful. That gives us some context. Now, Randy, why does your group and some community members immediately surrounding the parcel in particular oppose the project? What's the basis of the opposition?
I think this project raises a question that many towns and small cities in the Boston area face. How do we meet housing needs without damaging the quality of life? And the traffic on Needham Street is one of the most congested streets in Newton. As a resident of Newton, you've probably traveled that street yourself. I personally avoid it as much as possible. And traffic engineers have rated this level F.
What does that mean?
That means it's in failure.
And just to clarify, do you mean it's currently level F or they've rated the plan?
The intersections are level of service
it's
F.
It's currently level F for that particular intersection, which this development is being built on. And the average speed at peak times, according to the developer's own data, is 4 to 5 miles an hour.
And are you worried, Randy, that it's going to get worse?
Oh, it will definitely get worse. And I don't think there's any debate about it getting worse. The question is that okay to get worse? What can we do to try and mitigate that? And I think the city council and the land use committee spent an awful lot of time trying to figure out how to do that.
Okay. So I'm just going to pause you there again because I need to ask Deb one more question on that. Mm-hmm. And already we have 5 calls mm-hmm. already. Okay. So just very quickly, Deb, the question I have for you, did the city council do due diligence on the project, and particularly since Randy raised traffic?
Absolutely. We have known since the get-go that traffic, moving people to and from the project, was the problem we had to solve in order to get all of these other benefits and amenities for the community.
And will traffic be worse when the development?
Traffic's going to be worse whether we build this development or not. That's a really important point to understand. 70% of the traffic on Needham Street is from the western suburbs moving through Newton. Needham Street is slated for a complete makeover from Needham to Newton, $30 million the state is putting down. The work begins this year. That's going to help in terms of cleaning up the street, making protected bikeways and protected pedestrian ways, as well as widening the street here and there to make it consistent. And the big thing is traffic signals.
So just again, just to be clear, but none of that is part of Northwind development.
No.
Those are other plans.
And no development should have to take responsibility for existing traffic.
So there's a point of contention there.
Yep.
Okay. And I'm sorry, it's just so many voices and I want to get lots of different voices into this discussion. So I'm going to turn to a call. And although our lines are full, I'm going to put the number out because once we take a couple, there'll be room for more. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Fran on the line from the Waubun neighborhood of Newton. Fran, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I read in the Newton Patch a little while ago that right-sized Newton had declined to meet with Northland after several invitations to do so, including really early in the process. And I'm wondering why you didn't take them up on these opportunities. I met with them as an individual neighbor several times, and they always spent as much time as needed to answer my questions and listen to my ideas. I've also attended several hearings at City Hall over the past 2 years, and I recall at those hearings that a right-sized Newton representative was given equal time to present their side as the developer.
Okay, so
I'm wondering why they're saying that they haven't been heard.
All right, let's turn to Randy. Fran, thank you for that. We'll give Randy a chance to respond.
Well, Fran, thanks for raising the question about whether we answer questions. Well, we're right here answering questions. We've held a number of forums. And I have to say,
did you meet with Northland? Just because that was the heart of Fran's question.
The meeting with Northland. There have been a number of interactions with Northland over the past years. I think the issue with the neighborhood group that represented Upper Falls and Newton Highlands is that there was no negotiation. There was no give and take about what they needed.
I have read in news stories that there was a year of negotiation. So let me just
– 2 years, actually.
There was time for negotiation. So again, let me just broker here, both that there has been negotiation and also that the concern has been that negotiation – hasn't been deeply engaged with the immediate surrounding area. Would it be fair to characterize that those are the bones of contention in this conversation?
Well, I don't think entirely,
however, because there are members of the Upper Falls community. You know, I live there. I can walk there. I've lived there for 35 years. I think this is bringing wonderful things to our community, a terrific opportunity that I hate to see missed. There are many people within Upper Falls who contact me, some of whom have dared to put their presence forward on these local newsreels, blogs, whatever you call them, and others who are afraid to speak up, but who do support the project, who do see it as something that will help to actually knit the community together and provide opportunity for people in the community now, as well as the new community that would come, to mingle, to enjoy the spaces and places that are being developed.
So, Randy, before I go to a couple more calls, Deb just used the terms dare and afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Has it been that kind of contention back and forth between the sides? Has this been a painful or truly contentious? Because I'm noticing the words that I'm hearing.
Sure. I think that perhaps some people feel tense about this and regret that tension. I think there's also been some real education going on around these issues. These are very complicated questions about traffic and development and housing and transportation. So they don't come easily to everybody. So spending time on that is not necessarily a bad thing. But I take your point, which you mentioned earlier, about is a referendum a good way to deal with these things? And it probably isn't. And I think the fact that we're at a referendum point—
I'm going to note Deb's is, nodding
yes,
as you say that.
I think it's regrettable we're at the point of referendum. And to me, that's a symptom of the failure of leadership that has led to our current sort of differences of opinion.
Well, of course, I disagree with that. We've had a 2-year process. It began with something the mayor called a community engagement process where for about 6 months, two counselors, I was one, and a couple of dozen people from within a broad study area from Newton Highlands Village all the way to Newton Upper Falls and all the neighborhoods around the corridor engaged and articulated the essence of what they hoped Needham Street would become. The developer was asked to pause in order to listen to that process and not file.
How long was that pause?
About 6 months.
Okay.
And they did. They waited and they filed soon afterwards with a project that was dramatically different from what they started with.
And Randy, do you feel the project was – I'm anxious to get to callers, but I want to do fair brokering on this. Randy,
sure.
Do you feel that the project was dramatically different after the 6 months?
I
don't think you engaged in that process.
Yeah, I was not personally involved in that process.
Okay.
But I will say this, that it's really hard before a developer actually files plans to know exactly what they're planning. And when the developer first filed its plans, this was 1.5 million square feet of
1.9.
Development. And, well, we'll have to show you the document when we get off the air.
So we have disagreement on how big the original plan was.
And it's now 1.4 million square feet.
All right.
Is that about right? 1.4 million currently?
I want to grab some calls here.
Okay.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First, we have Donna. I'm going to try to grab a couple. We have Donna in Brockton, Massachusetts. Donna, go ahead.
My question is, why did they decide to make the development residential and office use? And my second question is, what offices are they going to have? Is it going to bring more businesses and therefore more people, or are there offices that are going to help the people in the community, like healthcare and things like that?
Okay, before I go to another caller, let's give you a chance, Deb.
An existing mill building that is 180,000 square feet that is going to be restored and re-tenanted for small offices. The idea for Needham Street is to actually, the developer, if we do this plan, would like to headquarter there, but the majority of it is for small think tank types of offices, high tech. With communal workspace and that sort of thing.
But also not maybe human services or the kinds of things that I think the caller was asking about, healthcare,
et cetera. No, this particular site is part of the what's called the N-Square or Newton-Needham corridor, and they're calling it an innovation corridor and trying to work with that.
Okay, and Randy, it sounded like the caller was implying that perhaps it should have been all housing and affordable housing. What's your thought on that?
Well, it is mostly housing and affordable housing. I think it's 80 to 85% of the square footage will be devoted to that purpose.
Okay, so that's a good answer for the caller. Let's take another call. We've got Jess calling now from Cambridge. Jess, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Can you hear me?
Yes. But I don't think you can hear me, Jess.
Can you hear me?
If we can get Jess back, I'll go back to Jess. But in the meantime, I'd like to try to grab one more caller. It looks like we've got Ken on the line from Newton Highlands. Newton. Ken, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi. I live very near the project, and I've been paying attention to it. And I've read the RSN site, and I can see that they're very opposed to it, but I can't see what they're in favor of. I can't see what solutions they're offering. It's a big parcel. It's not pretty now. And if you're not meeting with the developer and talking about solutions, I'm trying to understand what you're in favor of.
Okay, so let's turn to Randy then. So, Randy, what does Right Size Newton want?
Sure. The neighborhood group has written to the city council and described certain changes,
like what?
Such as
very
reducing it from 800 units to 400 units.
Has Right Size Newton opposed smaller developments elsewhere in the past?
Absolutely not. We are in favor of development. We are in favor of moderate development and smart development. And one of the issues here that smart development is supposed to consider is access to public transit. And public transit is, I'm afraid, not walkable from this site. So people talk about, oh, we need to build where there's public transit access. But when there isn't public transit access, that just seems to disappear.
Okay,
as
so
a
I'm
going to
give Deb a chance to respond.
We are making it accessible to public transit, and that is
There's
something that has worked
to
before.
The T as a part
yes,
of the proposal.
Yes, correct. We're a mile from public transit. Some people might walk or bike that, but there's nowhere to build right next to the Newton Highlands T station. There's nowhere to build next to the Elliott Street T station, the two closest ones. So, and other offices and other developments, particularly in Needham, which has been developing rapidly right nearby, have been using shuttle services very successfully to bring their people to the T and access public transportation. We believe this is going to work. The developer has committed to a free, frequent, shared ride service that'll run every day, 16 hours a day, and they're subsidizing T passes. They're doing a lot to encourage people. They're also limiting this to one-car living. So they're limiting their market to people who want to live car-light.
Okay, so I'm going to try to grab three calls in a row here if I can. It all depends on what the content is. Let's start with Jess. I think we've got Jess back now from Cambridge. Yeah. Jess, do we have you this time?
We do, and as a mental note, you need to turn off your radio and callers, disable your Bluetooth. I think that's what my problem was.
Good note to other callers. But, go ahead, Jess.
Okay. So I live in Cambridge, and I think that what no one's talking about, having lived through a large development like this, is we have zoning regulations in place, and we work hard to put the zoning regulations in place. And I'm sure this project is just like every other project. A developer comes in, they push the boundaries, they ignore the zoning laws, they build what they want to maximize profits. It goes through a process of rubber stamping through city council and planning boards. And at the end of the day, the residential communities don't have the capacity, the legal deep pockets, to continuously fight the developer. But
okay.
The developer has tremendous pockets, and as a result, we lose green space. And we lose.
I got to stop you there. I'm so sorry, Jess, but I want to get more voices in, and we heard a couple strong points from you. Let's go next to Lisa in Newton Highlands. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling about this huge issue of affordable housing crisis in the Boston area, in the country at large.
So what's concerning you about it?
I would just like the people that you're interviewing, Deb Crossley and the other
and Randy,
Mr. Block, to speak to how this project addresses that crisis.
All right, great. Let's talk about that for a second. And I'm actually, just because you spoke last, Deb, I'm going to go to Randy first. What about affordable housing and the need for affordable housing, Randy?
Well, we are in favor of more housing and more affordable housing. This developer is meeting the minimum requirements for affordable housing.
Isn't that usually the case?
Yes, that is often the case.
Okay.
This is an opportunity to try and do better than that, and
okay.
It is possible. There have been other developers in Newton where the city council has succeeded in achieving quite a bit more than the minimum. And
can you give an example? Because it would be helpful.
Austin Street, I think, has 33% affordable
okay.
housing.
And affordable housing in this case is 50 to 80% of area median income. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. Deb, one or two sentences there to add to that?
Other projects have different mixes of amenities. Every project is different. This project is bringing us a lot more. I mentioned at the beginning, yes, affordable housing, both at 50% and 80% and up to 120%, a total of 17.5% all told. Also, more smaller elevator accessible units, not deed restricted affordable, but housing that we very much need in the city so that some seniors who want to can get out of their houses that are too big where they're just living on the first floor and not have to move out of town.
Okay, so I've got about 1 minute left with the two of you, and I want to shift gears for a second and ask, where is the common ground? What can Right-Size Newton and the 17 city councilors who voted in favor of Northland find to work on together that addresses what I hear from you are shared concerns, but profoundly different approaches to how you want to think about that in the community? So where's the Pareto optimal region for the two of you?
So I'm not sure how to approach this question because there's been a two-year process, a lengthy public process. We've listened intently. We've made changes. We've pushed for a lot. We've negotiated a lot in this project, also through the special permit process, which we didn't get to dig into. The project, I think, now has the right balance. If traffic is the concern, it has the right balance. You can't have more affordable housing and more environmental controls and more open space. You have to strike a balance.
Okay.
We worked very hard to do that.
Let me go to you, Randy.
Well, I think it's a great question, and if we have some weeks and months to work on that, we may be able to find common ground. But right now, unfortunately, we are faced with an up or down vote on March 3rd. You're either going to vote yes and this development will be approved, or you're going to vote no and the development will be disapproved. And only if there's a no vote will there be an opportunity to reconsider this.
Which I have to cut in because there's not an opportunity to go back to the table if it's a no vote.
Okay.
You're voting the zoning down, not the project.
Okay. Yeah. So I got to end us there. That was Deb Crossley, Counselor at Large from Ward 5 in Newton. Thank you. And Randy Block, president of Right Size Newton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. In our last just a couple of minutes before we end, we want to turn to one more voice on this and other issues facing the city of Newton. Joining us on the line is the mayor of the city of Newton, Ruth Ann Fuller. Mayor Fuller, welcome to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, it's good to join you.
So, Mayor, I'm going to ask you the question I just asked at the end. After next Tuesday, a vote will have happened, and something will be the outcome. And regardless of what that outcome is, as a leader of your community, how do you bring Newton together after what seems like it's been a challenging and contentious public policy issue in your city?
What's so terrific about Newton is we have passionate, engaged members of our community all across the city, and together we will continue to forge a future for Newton that balances our need to welcome to Newton more people on tight incomes and build green buildings and protect our open space. And yes, sometimes we're going to have different points of view about how to get there, but we're going to continue to work together and make sure everybody's voices are heard.
So, Mayor Fuller, I know that I want to be transparent. I know that you are somebody who's been in support of the development. Part of the reason we wanted to have this conversation today is for lessons for other cities and towns. Given how this has unfolded, what advice would you give to city councils or mayors in other communities about how to pursue the challenges of development in those communities?
I would say keep leaning in to make sure that people's voices are heard. For this particular Northland project, there were over 300 meetings, 12 public hearings in front of the city council, 18 months of active revisions and negotiations and compromises. We have to make sure we continue to do that and listen actively to all the neighbors in Newton and bring those voices forward.
Yeah, I do want to ask because it sounds like the city wound up at a referendum stage because there were residents who, despite what you laid out there, didn't feel heard. Is there something you think you could have done differently to address that earlier?
So I think there are very good people here in Newton who are voting no on this. They firmly believe that some of the issues weren't resolved sufficiently. I think there are, it's important to have democracy work, and a vote will be taken. And I hope I am a strong yes vote on this. I think this is good for Needham Street and Newton Upper Falls and for Newton. And we'll see what the voters decide.
Okay, I want to get to a couple of other subjects very quickly. First, we are on the subject of land. I do want to ask you about Webster Woods. At the end of last year, city councilors voted to seize 18 acres of woodland of Webster Woods by eminent domain from Boston College, as the school might have developed it. That's been a controversial move. Where do you stand on that right now?
The city of Newton now owns in perpetuity Webster Woods. Those forests will remain forest forever. We have a strong conservation restriction on it, and we've cut a check to Boston College, and they have cashed that check.
Are they done contesting?
That's up to them. They've got 3 years to make up their mind, and we'll see.
Okay, lastly, the Boston Globe has been reporting some racial slurs being used in association with students at Newton North High School. Police are investigating. What is the latest, and what is your message to the community? And I apologize, you've got about 30 seconds for this.
We have had a spate of very hurtful, wrong, damaging incidents over at Newton North. Our educators, our police, our students are all over it, and this is not what Newton is all about. We stand united against racial discrimination and all forms of hate.
All right, that is Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller, Mayor of Newton. Thank you, too, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And as always, listeners, thanks for the calls. We love it when you engage. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And I am Tisiana Deering. And I invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.